Thank you, Dr. Kanger. We always give these bios to our chairs at panels, and they rarely read the whole thing. They kind of select, so that was a very overly gracious intro. I probably should have abbreviated it for the purposes of this.
It's too interesting. I had to read it off.
Well, thank you very much. It was very kind, and I'm grateful to be here. I am not a longtime member. I was invited by a friend who's not here, who is a longtime member of the Philadelphia Society, to speak because I guess they didn't have someone who was an expert on 19th century German social policy. So I'm going to stand in for my colleague in that regard and hopefully add something to the conversation here. So with that disclaimer, this talk is only indirectly about the origins of the welfare state in Bismarckian or post-Bismarckian Germany. Instead, I'm going to focus more on the role of German liberalism in shaping social policy in the wake of Bismarck's social reforms. Policy that would become, eventually, the social market economy and the foundation of the welfare state in the Federal Republic after 1945. So it gives you a kind of implication of where I'm going. Indeed, the reasons I want to focus on liberal social policy more than Bismarck's admittedly seminal welfare reforms are twofold. One, Bismarck's sickness insurance, accident insurance, and old age insurance laws were set up primarily to combat the rise of socialism. They were not set up out of any long-term investment in progressive social policy among the German conservatives with whom Bismarck was affiliated. Number two, it was liberalism, not Bismarckian conservatism or Marxist socialism, that defined Imperial Germany's transformations and legacies, including modern social policy and the welfare state, better than any contemporary political movement. So the socialists and the conservatives are interesting in understanding German social policy, but I would argue they're only indirectly involved in shaping it. To be sure, outside the field of German history, and sometimes still within it as someone who works on German liberalism, the liberals do not enjoy the reputation of their Anglo-Saxon counterparts. And for the audience today, I would say for good or ill. Either way, they're not to blame the weakness of German liberals for the tragedies of 20th century German history, from capitulating to Bismarck's authoritarian rule to abetting Germans' proclivity for nationalism and aristocratic modes of social behavior. Liberalism failed to spearhead a bourgeois revolution. This is the typical liberal or left-wing critique. They didn't sponsor social reform, and therefore they helped to perpetuate the imperialist reactionary tendencies that produced the First World War, collapse of the Weimar Republic, and of course, Nazism. So that's the left-wing or liberal critique of German liberals. On the right, of course, German liberalism, or at least progressive socially interventionist left liberalism, is deemed equally culpable, if for different reasons. Namely, in supporting a version of the welfare state that, per Hayek's argument in The Road to Serfdom, facilitated the totalitarian movements of the 20th century. So the German liberals get it from both sides. Neither interpretation, I'd like to argue today, is fair or accurate. To the contrary, German liberals in the last decades of the 19th century did their best to provide Germans a viable alternative, both in Germany down the road to serfdom. German liberals worked to find a progressive, reformist third way that combined the liberal, national, and social trends prevalent in 1880s and 90s German political culture. Faced by immense challenges on both the populist right and socialist left, they did not entirely succeed before 1914. But the liberal reformers who rose to prominence in the post-Bismarckian era did work out the basic premises of a left-liberal third way that would come to define the social policies of the Weimar Republic during its healthiest period, when it actually worked, and become the foundational ideology of the Federal Republic's social market economy and remarkably sustainable welfare state. And I don't know if anyone's going to talk about the European welfare state after 1945, but Germany might be the positive side of that equation. So who were the German liberals? Because of its protean nature and universal claims, German liberalism experienced multiple national, regional, and ideological permutations between the foundation of the German Empire in 1871 and the German Revolution of November 1918. In 1871, there were two major liberal factions. The National Liberals, which garnered the most seats in the First Imperial Reichstag, had a diverse membership ranging from the center-right-leaning chairman, Rudolf von Bennigsen, who was an ally of Bismarck, to center-left liberals like Bamberger and Theodor Barth. And when I say center-left and right, again, in the German context, that's complicated, because the left liberals were very often the free market liberals, and the right liberals were very often those who had no problem with the tariff policies of the conservatives to protect agrarian and heavy industry, right? So it's not the same as you might think in an Anglo-Saxon context. That's something we could talk about. The smaller, though hardly insignificant, left-liberal progressive party, under the leadership of Eugen Richter, who was the greatest free trader in the 1870s, and he's in the left-liberal party, the progressives, was complemented by the South German People's Party, also a progressive wing of German liberalism. Now, over the course of the 1870s, divisions emerged between center-left national liberals, who favored a break from Bismarck's tariff and military policies, and the national liberal majority, which wanted to maintain a close alliance with the protectionist and militarist conservatives. In 1884, these center-left secessionists, as they were called, merged with Richter's progressives to create the German Freethinking Party. But less than a decade later, long simmering differences over military and social spending divided the radicals, as they called themselves, once again, with many former Richterites joining the Free Trading Radical People's Party and many erstwhile secessionists joining the more imperialist pro-government Radical Union. And this Radical Union then got a new infusion of progressive liberalism with Friedrich Naumann and the National Social Verein, or association, joining them in 1903. Naumann, whose views parallel those of Franz Oppenheimer, with whom he worked, and other late 19th century social liberal thinkers, wanted to create a unified front along national, social, and liberal lines. So something between Marxist socialism and conservatism slash free market liberalism. Indeed, thanks to Naumann's efforts, the radical factions coalesced in 1910 to form the United Progressive People's Party. Hence, by the end of the imperial period, German liberalism was again divided into two wings, a center-right National Liberal Party and a center-left Progressive Party, a division that would carry forward into the Weimar Republic. For much of the Bismarckian era and post-Bismarckian period, these two wings of German liberalism dominated the Reichstag, most provincial parliaments, and many local governments. Together, they regularly received more than 40% of the popular vote before 1880. To be sure, as the working-class population increased, liberals experienced a notable decline in relative electoral support and representation. But even in the last two elections preceding the First World War, 1907 and 1912, the liberals received more than a quarter of the popular vote, second only to the socialists. More important than their electoral representation, the liberals boasted many of the nation's leading social reformers and critics. Standing at the center of debates over trade and tariff policy, welfare and work programs, civil rights and education, in short, most aspects of social policy we associate with the modern welfare state. Now, in the traditional historiography, German liberals come off as increasingly out of touch with modern industrial society. According to many liberal historians and left-wing critics, German liberals, and by the way, the liberal historians in Germany and the Marxists are very different, but they tend to agree on this. According to these critics, German liberals ignored the need for greater state intervention in social policy while promoting economic and cultural policies that alienated the majority of workers and lower middle classes, opening the way for both the far left and the far right. So that's the critique. Since the 1980s, this conventional impression has undergone revision. Far from sitting on the sidelines of modernity, many revisionist scholars observe the liberal parties played a crucial role in most parliamentary compromises regarding social security and health insurance benefits, penal reform and education, religion, minority policy, and civil rights. So they're at the center, not on the margins. Certainly, much of the liberals' initial focus in the Bismarckian era was on occupational training and so-called self-help, Selbsthilfe, that is, free market solutions to social problems, especially while Richter was chairman of the Radical People's Party. Also important, the liberals, from Max Weber to Werner Sombart, produced some of Wilhelmine Germany's most prominent pessimists and social critics, so they weren't always excited about what was going on. But as Kevin Repp and other historians, including myself, have argued, German liberals enlisted controversial tropes like popular ethnic nationalism not primarily in order to combat modernity, not because they were peculiarly German and backwards-looking and loved Nazis, but to meet the challenges of Germany's rapid industrialization, urbanization, and proletarianization in liberal as opposed to conservative or Marxist ways. That is, Germany modernized faster and more violently than most countries, and the liberals were trying to figure out how to deal with that. The left liberal women's leader, Gertrude Bäumer, for example, who was also a leading feminist, was typical of many left liberals in proclaiming the victory of the racial idea in natural and social science, an idea that would help Germany transcend the debilitating materialism of the 19th century. But rather than capitulate to the quote, and this is her quote, inhumanity of creating racist mastermen, liberals like Bäumer and her mentor Naumann appropriated and hoped to implement the findings of modern biology, anthropology, and sociology in order, quote, to reconcile the twin impulses of social and scientific progress, inextricably intertwined in these reformers' vision of modernity, by making the ideals of liberal humanism more corporeal and more concrete. That was Bäumer's term. So how do we weave a path between the right-wing nationalists who want to get rid of Jews and use, you know, restrictive immigration policies to get rid of Poles and other foreigners, and the Marxist left, which would like to get rid of Germany's kind of distinctive cultural and social characteristics, right? Again, they're trying to weave a path between these two extremes. Liberal women were progressive-minded activists who sometimes found it advantageous to employ the biopolitical rhetoric of race and empire to promote women's political representation, education reform, and family policy. If they think women are naturally different, let's use that language, as you could call it a second wave feminism, to get women's rights, not because they wanted to eugenicize everything. Bäumer herself supported decriminalization of abortion and its legality in cases of rape, threat to life of the mother, or serious likelihood of handicap. Yet she opposed the socialist Helena Stoker in promoting women's universal right to an abortion, simultaneously rejecting the stronger racialist eugenicist thinking of her German conservative and radical right-wing counterparts, who started talking about sterilization and euthanasia at that time. When it came to the majority of male liberals, women's rights remained a contentious topic. If few liberals questioned the capacity of Jews to participate in German political or social life, ironically, you might say, the matter of women's natural mental and emotional inferiority preoccupied liberal politicians. Still, German liberals were less anti-feminist than their French counterparts. Not a surprise, as many of you know, the French did not give women the vote till the 1940s. Alternating between an underlying skepticism regarding women's capacity for full political participation and a support for female suffrage and women's issues in a pragmatic attempt to get liberal majorities. So again, on women's issues, they're in the middle. Recent scholarship on the relationship between liberals, Jews, and Catholics also illustrates liberalism's attempt to weave a path between left and right, utopian socialism, and exclusionary conservatism. And again, the German conservative movement is different than the American one, right? There's less of a classical liberal basis for it. So when I use conservatism, I'm using it in the German context. Of course, the Jews faced rising anti-Semitism from the 1880s onwards, often from elements of the same urban and small-town middle classes that supported the liberal parties. So anti-Semitism is strong in the liberal constituencies. But this rise of grassroots anti-Semitism among liberal voters did not dissuade German Jews from supporting the liberals, which they viewed as the best representatives of universal values, the ones that our speaker yesterday talked about, these Anglo-Saxon values of small government and universal rights, modern culture, and socially responsible capitalism. That is, most of the Jews were wealthy and or middle-class professionals. They supported capitalism, but they also believed in social reform and the welfare state. In fact, German Jews provided much of the municipal leadership, liberal press corps, and a significant percentage of the liberal constituency. In contrast to the Jews, who were the quintessential German liberals, the Catholics became the bugbear for all that was medieval and reactionary in German politics and society. I'm from a liberal perspective, not from the Catholic perspective. In fact, the liberals, quote, stigmatization of Jesuits, priests, monks, and Catholics, Michael Gross contends, helped, quote, orient their vision of German society toward modern rationalism, individualism, industrialization, and free market capitalism. Anti-Catholicism was not just an exception to liberal principles, that is, they were being intolerant, but the culmination of liberal demands for a modern state. So the Catholics represented what was wrong with Germany, the Jews represented what was right with Germany from a liberal perspective. And again, you see tendencies in this regard among Protestant liberals, or classical liberals, conservatives in our own society, not as much anymore. Gross's study of liberal anti-Catholicism comports with Repp's work on Wilhelmine social reformers and my own research on ethnic and racialist thinking among Wilhelmine liberals in acknowledging the intolerant, exclusionary, even racist and xenophobic potential of German liberalism. So German liberals did have racist proclivities that we see in all nationalist groups in Central Europe in the middle of the late 19th to the middle of the 20th century. There's little question that liberal intellectuals like Thomas Mann, Sombart, and Max Weber gradually lost much of the progressive optimism they evinced in the 1890s, transforming by the eve of the First World War into critics of materialism, mass culture, and so-called soulless science they associated with Wilhelmine modernity. Insofar as they produced many of Imperial Germany's most vocal critics and enthusiastic imperialists, however, liberals continue to promote a socially progressive, moderately interventionist program in a political landscape dominated by left and right-wing extremism, domestic instability, and foreign policy tensions. At the same time, liberal social policy made itself felt on the local as well as the national level. So again, they believe in doing things on a local level, like many liberals today still believe, right, as opposed to the national government doing everything. In her case study of the Deutsche Werkbund, with whom Naumann and his left liberal protege Heuss were affiliated, Maiken Umbach shows how the German arts and crafts movement shaped the German city in modern, functional, and socially inclusive ways on a local level, city by city. Jennifer Jenkins' work on liberalism in Hamburg illustrates that the local might be the perfect location to develop a uniquely contemporary liberal idea of municipal social policy in terms of welfare and work, space and architecture. That is, let people do this on the local level in the name of the constituents, not have the Bismarckian Prussian state dictate it. See the paradox there? It's Bismarck and the conservatives who represent arbitrary state power, and the liberals are trying to protect localism. In short, Germany's leading liberal reformers, quote, strove to apply scientific thought to every process and every social and industrial problem while showing the greatest concern for health and well-being, education and training of workers, artists, and commercial men, pushing, in the words of Kevin Repp, to correct the abuses and injustice of the modern world without relinquishing the promise of scientific and technological advance. Refusing flight into utopias or resignation, they took a stand on contemporary ground. In conclusion, the quintessentially modern, reform-minded liberalism that I've described today did not succeed in the decades after Bismarck's fall. Faced with the inherent challenges of modernity itself, the consequences of rapid industrialization, a burgeoning socialist left and populist right, the divide between urban cosmopolitans and small-town provincials, all these forces undermine the ability of progressives and national liberals to inscribe their national, social, and liberal vision in the parliamentary arena. And yet, German liberals of the late 19th century, in the words of Repp, vigorously contested the claims of radicals on both the left and the right, following a path that reformers in other industrializing countries took past the same landmarks. Marxism and Darwinism, humanistic ethics, rationalization, order and efficiency, the twin Enlightenment impulses of human emancipation and scientific and technological advance. More importantly, the German liberals continued their role of brokering between left and right, socialism and capitalism, state and civil society during the First World War and throughout the Weimar Republic. While critical of socialist and certainly communist demands for nationalization of industry and skeptical of welfare outlays beyond a limited purview, Weimar liberals defended unemployment insurance, disability insurance, health insurance, state-sponsored job training, women's reproductive rights. Indeed, already in the 20s and early 30s, Weimar Democrats began to coalesce around a national, social, and liberal New Deal that, quoting another historian, anticipated by Naumann's circle before the First World War, was a kind of third-way alternative to liberal capitalist as well as Marxist socialist designs. As I've argued elsewhere, German liberals continue to navigate a space between free market capitalism and socialism in the Third Reich, led by Finance Minister Hjalmar Schacht, a liberal industrialist Robert Bosch, and ordo-liberals like Ludwig Erhard and Alfred Müller-Armach. They proposed a third way in the Third Reich that had many proponents before the totalitarian tendencies and police repression of the Second World War delayed implementation. Indeed, the ordo-liberals of the interwar years, the heirs to Oppenheimer and Naumann, shared some of Hayek's views about the constitution of liberty and the danger of Marxist socialism. How could they not? But it's no coincidence that Naumann's protege, Theodor Heuss, became the first president of the Federal Republic, while the ordo-liberal Ludwig Erhard, as economic minister and later chancellor, ushered the ideas of a social market economy and welfare state into the post-war world. The incubator for these initiatives, ones that have proved more sustainable in Germany than any other large industrialized country, was the liberal reformist milieu of the Bismarckian and post-Bismarckian era. That the first elements of the German welfare state resulted from a combination of socialist pressures and Bismarck's political farsightedness should not divert our attention from the fact that the success of German social policy over the past century, one that's avoided the road to serfdom in weaving a path between left, socialist left, and capitalist, laissez-faire capitalist right, owes a significant debt to the liberal reformist milieu of the 1880s and 90s. Thank you.